Hi, everybody. Today is Tuesday, May 13th, 2025, and our friends Scott Ritter and Professor Marandi are back with us. Welcome back.
Thanks. Thank you, Nima.
And let's get started, Scott, with you. And the new, I don't know if you saw the new article in the New York Times. They're talking about that Houthis and were able to shut down F-16 and F-35 jets. And is that what it, one of the main reasons that Donald Trump has decided to get something in with Yemen?
No, not at all. There's a difference between this is written by somebody who doesn't understand anything about combat, etc. You know, if you fly an aircraft into a defended airspace, you can be shot down. Because they have defensive capabilities. This is why we train our pilots in certain tactics. This is why we use, electronic warfare, et cetera, to prevent from being shot down. But there's a difference between being engaged and being shot down. There's no doubt that the Houthi engaged F-16 and F-35 aircraft. There's no doubt that American aircraft had to take, defensive measures to avoid being shot down. Welcome to war. This is missing the point. The point isn't that the Houthi engaged F-16s and F-35s. The point is that the Houthi beat the United States. That's what we have to, let's think strategically. Let's stop getting down into the weeds. I'm not picking on you, but I mean, this is an absurdity. The United States entered a military campaign. Let's just be fair to General Kurilla and the Central Command. They rightfully said that they needed to engage in a multi-month long campaign to degrade Yemen's air defense capabilities and to, this strategic air campaign designed to defeat Yemen. Very expensive, and we would have run out of ammunition. And the political direction was, no, we need to compress this into a 30-day campaign. Which General Kurilla attempted to do, and we failed. We didn't defeat the Houthi. We didn't suppress the Houthi. They continued to be able to not only fire against Israel, but to also threaten American shipping, to include military shipping. The most important thing here is that the Houthi were developing a targeting solution for U.S. naval warships, including the Harry S. Truman. We saw this played out in reality, when the Harry S. Truman had to take emergency evasive action to avoid being struck by a Houthi weapon that caused an F-18 that was being put into position for launch to be thrown overboard. That tells me that the Houthi understood the window of vulnerability. Aircraft carriers, when they launch aircraft, when they recover aircraft, are very vulnerable because those are period of times when you can't maneuver or you shouldn't be maneuvering. You should be maintaining a constant heading so the airplanes can take off and airplanes can land. And what it is that the Houthi apparently were able to understand when the United States was going to be preparing to launch or recover aircraft and the time their attacks accordingly. This could be fatal for the Harry S. Truman. Not only that, the Truman had run out of ammunition. It needed to get out of Dodge. There was concern that if it went through the Suez Canal, it would be a sitting duck. It is a sitting duck in the Suez Canal. And if the Houthi obviously have weapons that can reach the Suez Canal, and the Truman would be very vulnerable there. So it needed to extricate itself along the coastline. And there was concern that the Houthi would be able to strike this. So we needed to save our ships. This is humiliating for the United States. Absolutely humiliating for the United States. That's the story. The story isn't about F-16s and F-35s. The story is that the United States Navy was not only unable to defeat the Houthi, the Ansarallah, but had put itself in a very exposed position where it could be subjected to tactical defeat, the sinking of ships. And the bigger story here is that if the Houthi can do this to the United States in the Red Sea, imagine what Iran could do in the Persian Gulf or in the in the Indian Ocean. So this is a lesson learned to the United States, and hopefully it's a humbling experience, one that we take on board. I don't want to get ahead of the game, but there's so much else involved in this, because the initiative wasn't the United States dealing with the Houthi or the Houthi dealing with the United States. And maybe Professor Miranda will correct me if I'm wrong, but Iran played a very important role in this, because Iran is in the midst of, I think, what's going to be a very successful negotiation, one that could bring in, at least potentially, an end to the threat of war between the United States and Iran. But it's a sensitive period of negotiations that could be undermined if the United States were humbled by Houthi, compelled to escalate, to, as Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, said, hold Iran accountable. I mean, my God, we're in the midst of negotiations with the Iranians to try and resolve a major issue, and the Secretary of Defense is talking about bombing Iran. Bombing Iran with what? The same fleet that's under threat from the Houthi? I think the Iranians wisely stepped in and said, we need to de-escalate this situation so that these negotiations have a fair chance. There's no guaranteed outcome on these negotiations, but I've heard positive things coming out of the Iranian side that I haven't heard in a long time. And I've heard similarly positive things coming out from the United States. And it would just be a shame that this chance for a negotiated settlement on this major issue, Iran's nuclear program, and the potential lifting of sanctions and I'm not going to say normalization of relations, but stabilizing relations between the United States and Iran, that it would be put at risk because Nasrallah kicked America's butt in the Red Sea. So I think Iran played a major role in this. And that's the other aspect of the story that's so much more important than whether an F-16 was forced to take evasive maneuverings or an F-35 had to likewise, you know, fire off chaff and flares and avoid being shot down.
Professor Marandi, go ahead. Your take on what Scott said.
I think that Scott is absolutely correct. The United States failed in the Red Sea. It was a catastrophic mistake. I think all of us were on different programs saying that this will end in failure. The only people who apparently didn't see it coming was the U.S. government for one reason or another. It's important that in this sense that Ansarullah was also not only able to fire its missiles and drones and harass the Americans. They lost three F-18s for one reason or another. They lost a number of very expensive drones, which were very key for their operations. But also the fact that F-35s in particular were threatened, according to the New York Times, shows that Ansarullah has a very high degree of sophistication. And if they can track U.S. Stealth jets, then as Scott was alluding to in a different way, imagine what Iran can do in the Persian Gulf or the Indian Ocean, or even in the Red Sea, because Iran's reach goes all the way to the Mediterranean and the Red Sea. So I think it is a lesson for the Americans to learn that military conflict with Iran, a conventional war would end in failure. Ansarullah, from my understanding, from the very beginning, was managing escalation. And from my understanding, they do have the ability to strike the ships and to strike the aircraft carrier, but they chose not to use their more sophisticated weapons because they did not want extreme escalation. So, and this is true about Hezbollah in Lebanon as well. It's true about the axis of resistance. The whole policy in defense of the Palestinians has been death by a thousand cuts, in the sense that not to push too far, not to push too hard, but to keep the pressure going. So, for example, well, there are capabilities that Hezbollah has that it didn't use for its own reasons. There are capabilities that Ansarullah had that they don't use. But I think it is important that the United States was forced to back down. With regards to the nuclear negotiations, it's very difficult to say. What Scott says is true, but it's true for today. But, you know, 5 minutes from now, we could have something on Truth Social, which is completely different. One of the things that I find interesting, which has nothing to do with Iran, is the fact that Trump backed down in the trade war against China, and he effectively capitulated. Now, that may be a failure for Trump, but it does show that he has the ability to change his position. And instead of just going down a one-way street, he has the ability to retreat. Now, he's very good at promoting himself, and he's very good at with the media, so he may be able to try to create an image for many that he succeeded with China. That's not really the point. The point is that he changed direction. So it is part, and the same is true with Ansarullah. He said Ansarullah capitulated. He used that word, in fact, but the reality was literally the opposite. But still, what is important is not whether he would, in this context, whether he was dishonest or not, or whether he was honest or not, but the fact that he was able to, instead of doubling down and going after Ansarullah further, or doubling down and continuing with the trade war with China and bringing down probably the U.S. economy to some deep recession, at least, he changed course. And that is possible, therefore, with Iran. So when we hear some very, let's say, discouraging words from Witkoff, because to Witkoff, initially, he spoke very positively and very reasonably. And then two things happened more recently. One was he retweeted the Secretary of Defense's tweet against Iran, which Scott alluded to, which surprised many that he would retweet that. The second was when he did an interview with Breitbart, and he said that no enrichment and that all has to go. But because of what we're seeing in with regards to China and Yemen, but also some of the changes that are taking place, which I don't know really how far it's going to go, but this direct negotiations with Hamas and that sort of thing, that to me means that it's possible that Witkoff in private could be saying something else. He could be more reasonable, because ultimately Iran's not going to accept the shutting down of its nuclear program or its enrichment program. Iran, and I think I should point this out, even though it's not directly linked to our discussion, enrichment for Iran is important because the United States has sanctioned everything in Iran. And even when Trump, I'm not sure if it was during Trump or Obama, perhaps both, there was a period of time when Iran was importing gasoline, and they were trying to prevent Iran from importing gasoline. And so that led to this policy in Iran that we must be able, sort of like what Trump is nowadays saying about the United States economy, but we must become self-sufficient in certain things, and that includes the nuclear program, that includes energy, and that's why Iran will simply not compromise on enrichment, but on the principle of enrichment. But there is a possibility, obviously, that if there is a deal, Iran could end higher degrees of enrichment, or it won't destroy any of its equipment, but it could put some in storage or something like that. But again, because of some of the things that we've been seeing over the past few days, literally, I think it's fair to say that despite some of the things that Witkoff has said and done, I think it's quite possible that behind the scenes he's going to be more reasonable at the negotiating table, at least.
Yeah. By the way, one of the good signs, Scott, with Donald Trump and his attitude is the new sort of talks between the United States and Hamas. And they have released a prisoner, an Israeli-American prisoner, and to show some sort of goodwill gesture to the United States. And do you find it right now? It seems that you follow the Israeli media. It seems that they're in panic right now. What's going on, in your opinion, with the case of Hamas?
You know, as Professor Morandi has noted, give Trump 24 hours and you're going to have a completely different emotionally based, foundation of American policy. And then give him another 24 hours and it's going to shift all over the place. I can't explain why he does this. Is this strategy on his part? Is it that he's a weak-minded individual who simply repeats the last thing whispered into his ear by whatever advisor's closest to him? It's very difficult to assess this. I've been trying to give Trump the benefit of the doubt. I've spent a lot of time trying to superimpose strategic thinking on his actions, shoehorning it in sometimes when it's difficult to do so. I can't, it's hard. I'll give you my take, but I'm prefacing by, this is very hard to do. It's very hard to understand what's going on. I think I'm done with giving Donald Trump grand strategic capacity, meaning, I don't view him as the modern day Clausewitz or Sun Tzu or, masterful tactician as strat. I view him as a very simple minded man who is not able to comprehend fully the complexity of the issues he's articulating about. He acts on not on depth of understanding and knowledge, but on very shallow reasons. And because he is a narcissist, many of these reasons revolve around issues of his ego. And I think what we see with Israel is that he feels betrayed by Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, it's as simple as if you've watched The Godfather, Godfather 2, Michael Corleone and Fredo, and Trump has now kissed Fredo and he's sending him out on a fishing boat and Fredo's going to get a bullet in the back of the head. That's Netanyahu's fate. Netanyahu may not know it right now, but he messed with The Godfather. He lied to The Godfather. He betrayed The Godfather. He went behind The Godfather's back. He reached out to Michael Waltz. He set up a secret communication line with Michael Waltz and conspired with Michael Waltz to go against Donald Trump's policy objectives. And this is unforgivable from the Donald Trump world. And so now Benjamin Netanyahu is going to pay a price. And this price then is translates into American policy. One of Benjamin Netanyahu's greatest domestic political weaknesses is the hostage issue. If you've been studying what's happening in Israel, you know that Netanyahu has lied to the Israeli people from day one about he has no intention of letting the hostages go. He will kill them all. And he wants to kill them all. He is trying to kill them all. He's not trying to rescue them. This is a man who lied to the Israeli people, tried to blame Hamas for the failure of the release of the hostages. He's under investigation right now, according to an article written by Seymour Hersh. And I respect Seymour Hersh and I respect his sources. Netanyahu, early on, the Israeli forces apparently captured some Hamas internal policy documents. And one of them was what Hamas's posture was vis-a-vis the hostages. And according to this document, there was some thinking on the part of some that Sinwar should take the hostages, leave Gaza, and take the hostages to Iran. But what was missing is how Sinwar and everybody came back and said, no, the hostages remain. We will stay here in Gaza. We're not doing that. So it was just a proposal put out by somebody. It was immediately shot down. But this document exists. So what Netanyahu did is sent one of his advisors to this document is so secret that the Israelis refuse to acknowledge it exists. It's in a reading room in the Israeli intelligence headquarters, and you have to sign in. You're not allowed to take notes. You're allowed to read the document and leave. This guy went in there, copied the document verbatim, and came out, and Netanyahu released it on national TV, made reference to it as if to condemn Hamas. He's now under investigation for violating state secrets and for lying straight to the Israeli people. This hostage issue is emotional. You have the family of the hostages recognizing that this prime minister will kill their people. And so the United States had been respectful of Netanyahu's policy prerogatives because, of course, the Trump administration has, you know, staffed itself with more pro-Israeli Zionists per square inch than any other administration. But that doesn't mean that Donald Trump is a pro-Israeli Zionist. It means he's a politician who understands the importance of the pro-Israeli lobby in facilitating his victory, et cetera. But when Netanyahu lied to him, Trump now has the weapons he has. How do you demonstrate the weakness of Benjamin Netanyahu and how he blames Hamas? What Trump did is he said, I'll negotiate direct with Hamas and I'll get the American freed. And it happened. Boom. Which proves all at once, all Netanyahu had to agree to is negotiations and he could get the hostages freed. That the problem isn't Hamas, the problem is Netanyahu. Now Netanyahu is a huge political problem and that's what Trump wants. And now Netanyahu is desperate. He's panicking. He's talking about an all-out war on Gaza. I can't predict what, like Professor Moroni said, wait 24 hours. Who knows what Trump's going to tweet or post on Truth Social. But I will say this. Trump has said that the United States will not support further military operations into Gaza. And if Netanyahu seeks to do that, we may be looking at a strategic break with Israel. A strategic break, not because it's the policy of the United States, because Michael Corleone has decided to put a bullet in the back of Fredo's head. As long as Netanyahu is the prime minister of Israel, and if he does things that are against what Donald Trump wants, there will be a price to be paid. Netanyahu is talking about, detoxing Israel from American security. Good luck with that, Bibi. We run your damn country. We own your country. This is what I've said all along. Everybody's like, Israel owns America. I said, no, it doesn't. Not even close. We own Israel. Israel can't do anything without us. And if Netanyahu wants to try to be independent, he's betting on support from an American establishment that isn't going to go against Donald Trump on this one. Donald Trump has made some choices. I don't know how far this is going to go. Like you said, Marco Rubio could come whisper in his ear tomorrow and Trump's going to, Benjamin Netanyahu is the greatest person in the world. I love him like a brother. He's great. Then the next day, Witkoff comes in and tells him something. Benjamin Netanyahu is the scum of the earth. He should be shot on sight. Who knows what this man child who is the president of the United States is going to do? Because that's what he is, a man child. This isn't an adult. This is a man child with adult-like capability. This is the danger of giving a five-year-old kid a loaded pistol. And that's what we've done by electing this man as our president. This is an embarrassment. I have never been more embarrassed in my life than the performance of this president, because it's not the performance of a rational actor. It's the performance of a narcissist, egomaniac who puts his own personal interests ahead of the nation that he's supposed to lead. But when it comes to Gaza and when it comes to Hamas, I mean, how do we assess this? I mean, you want me to say something like, it's amazing that the United States is now negotiating directly with Hamas. Well, it is amazing that we're doing that. I agree. But what does it mean? Is it reflective of a strategic shift that says we now recognize Hamas as a legitimate political body within the Palestinian nation? And when Trump says maybe he'll talk to the Saudis about recognizing a Palestinian state, that Hamas will be part of that governing authority, because that goes directly against every pronouncement ever made by Trump about Hamas. So is this formal policy, or is this just the man child doing something to get revenge on Netanyahu? It's impossible for me to say at this juncture.
Professor Morandi, your take on Hamas?
I just wanted to explain something that Scott said. I think that document, if I'm not mistaken, was misused by Netanyahu and his team and misinterpreted for the public to imply that the martyr Yahya Sinwar wanted to leave and take them, take the prisoners with him. But in reality, it was saying something different. He wanted to imply that it was his. But I think what Scott is saying is absolutely correct. But again, as he also pointed out, we don't know what's going to happen in a few hours from now. We don't know what Trump is going to post on Truth Social. Even if, for example, we do have a nuclear deal with the United States, it wouldn't be the JCPOA, because I was saying today to someone, it would have to be the JCPOA plus plus, in the sense that it would have to recognize Iran's technological advancements over the last few years, because it came at a great price. Scientists were martyred and Iran was under sanctions, and the Americans are not going to compensate for that. And also, it's going to have to end the loopholes that existed in the original JCPOA, which Obama used to cheat Iran. And so did Trump until he tore up the deal. The United States, whenever would cheat Iran, there were no consequences for their actions. They paid no political price, let alone any other price. So a potential nuclear deal, if we ever get there, and that's not for certain, of course, would be substantially different from the JCPOA. It would have to be under. It would have to be more. It would have to take these issues into account. But even if we do have a deal with the United States, the problem goes back again to what Scott was saying, and that is, you sign a deal hypothetically, and then tomorrow you have something on Truth Social which completely negates everything and says, "Well, no, I don't like this deal, and we're going to have to do something else." So it makes working with the United States very, very difficult. I don't want to say impossible, because I don't want to, you know, rule out any success. It just shows how complicated it is. Even the negotiations with China, what Trump did was he went back to where the United States was before Liberation Day. We have the same tariffs that existed back then. The only difference now is that besides the fact that a lot of damage has been caused, but also there's now a three-month period where the two sides have to negotiate. And during these 3 months, business people don't know what to do. They won't know whether to purchase goods, to move their factories, to invest, not to invest. Because there will be this sense of, it's ambiguous where things will be in the weeks and months ahead. It's unclear, and I think that that's a problem that we're going to face with the United States and Iran. It's a problem that Ansarullah will have to face. If I was Ansarullah, which I'm sure they would. Upgrading their military capabilities, they're bringing in new weapons, they're developing new technology. Why? Because we don't know, and they don't know definitely what's going to happen in the weeks ahead. So this is the problem with Trump. His supporters call it strategic uncertainty, but I think it's more the man-child definition. I think the man-child definition of Scott is more accurate. I think it's more of chaos than anything else. And this is something that we're going to have to deal with, not just Iran, the Russians. I mean, one other very interesting thing has been how Trump has sort of evolved over the past few months with regards to Russia. He could have on day one ended the war, because he had momentum. He had won all the swing states. He won the popular vote, and he said during his campaign that he's going to end the war. He could have stopped it. He could have given the Russians the key concessions that they needed. The Russians probably would have given him some concessions to get this over with, but he would have had to give most of what Russia wanted, and then it would have been over. But he didn't do that, and now he's gradually, not completely, but sometimes he's sounding more like Biden nowadays. Now he's not Biden. He's not there. But Kellogg obviously seems to be as if he's a Biden employee. So the point is that we don't know where Trump is going to be on Russia, on Ukraine, where he's going to be on China, where he's going to be on global trade, where he's going to be on Iran, Yemen, Palestine in the weeks ahead. Everything is ambiguous. This, in my opinion, is actually in the long run beneficial to countries like Iran, because this uncertainty is causing countries to start to make increasingly think about making decisions and excluding the United States. Now, of course, the trade war itself was an incentive for this, and other issues also created this incentive, the sanctions and so on. But I think that this chaos in Washington is another catalyst that will push the global majority, the global South, perhaps some in Europe, who knows, to rethink their place in the global order. And I think that's going to speeden the tilt away from the United States.
Scott, how much of, you've mentioned the recognition of a Palestinian state, how much of a game changer that would be if the United States under the Trump administration decides to do that?
We come to the problem, decides to do what? I mean, today he says, you know, he's in Saudi Arabia right now. Who knows, today, tomorrow, he and the Saudis may sit down and get the grand bargain that that some people are talking about, where Saudi Arabia says, we will recognize the state of Israel. We will normalize relations with the state of Israel, which is the fulfillment of the Abrams Accord, in exchange for Trump saying, I recognize a Palestinian state, a two-state solution. Okay. And then the next day, when Hamas says, well, we're ready, and he goes, well, no, Hamas doesn't get to participate in this. Well, how can you talk about a Palestinian state without Hamas? They haven't been beaten. You know, they're sort of, if there was an election, you believe in democracy, don't you, Mr. President? I mean, we hear J.D. Vance and everybody else talking to the Europeans. Shame on you, Europe, for not being a good, free, democratic society, as suppressing AFD, suppressing Marine Le Pen, suppressing Georgescu in Romania. You guys aren't democratic at all, but we're going to suppress the hell out of Hamas because we don't respect the Palestinian people. We don't respect their ability to choose their leader. This is what happens when you have a man who knows nothing about anything making policy decisions about some of the most complex issues there are out there. Is there a solution to the Hamas issue? Yes. China's been working on one. Russia's been working on it. They've brought people, I think it was 14 different factions together to try and come up with some sort of singularity that included Hamas but wasn't called Hamas. And Hamas was part of that discussion. Why doesn't the United States respect this? Why don't we participate in that? Ask to be briefed on that, help facilitate that. So when we sit down with the Saudis, we say we could support a Palestinian state, but we need the Chinese model of governance here. That would imply that you actually know something about the problem and you're prepared to come up with a solution. But Trump is just simply, he hasn't reversed any of the policy statements he made about Hamas. Hasn't reversed a single one. We're negotiating with them, although supposedly we don't negotiate with terrorists, but we'll let that one slide for a moment because America's always negotiated with terrorists, or what we call terrorists. But what is the policy on Hamas? Because you can't talk about a Palestinian state unless you have a policy on Hamas. A two-state solution implies there will be a Palestinian government. If there's an election today, the Palestinian people would vote overwhelmingly for Hamas. How do we handle that? So I don't know. I'm at wit's end because for 100 days I called a truce. And you know this, Nima. You know that I did this. You know that I did my very best to be fair towards the Trump administration, to give the Trump administration a chance to act out on the policies that Trump was articulating during the campaign, for Trump to build a team capable of fulfilling these campaign promises, turning them into, policy that can be implemented. And it was very difficult, watching Trump move forward on this because it just vacillated day at Russia. I mean, Professor Murray is right. He's all over the map on Russia. The Jekyll and Hyde nature of the Trump administration is playing itself out, and that, according to the latest news, Steve Witkoff and Keith Kellogg are both going to be in Istanbul as observers. but I mean, this is literally Two-Face, that character from Batman. You know, one face is good, one face is ugly, and which face are we going to get? Are we getting both faces? This is stupidity. Stupidity. It shows immaturity. First of all, Marco Rubio should say, no, I am going to be there. Or if you're going to pick a special envoy, pick one. Tell the world where you stand. But this, you know, this notion that Trump's a genius, Trump's a master. He's sending Witkoff and Kellogg in so that the Ukrainians, the Russians, the Turks, and everybody have no idea what he's doing. That's because Trump has no idea what he's doing. That's because Trump isn't a leader enough to tell Keith Kellogg, sit down and shut up. If you ever open your mouth again while I'm having a guy speak about Russian policy, which Kellogg has done repeatedly. Repeatedly, Trump will have Witkoff or somebody make a statement about the progress he's made, and Kellogg shows up on TV and says something that undermines everything. Now, either Trump wants that to happen, or Trump isn't a strong enough leader to fire Kellogg, because that's firing offense. Any other administration, Kellogg would be fired for that. Any other administration, Kellogg would be fired for that. Because that's stabbing the president in the back. But Trump is now rewarding this man by sending him with co-equal status with Steve Witkoff, who's the problem solver, which tells me that Trump doesn't want to solve the problem, that Trump's there to muddy the waters. Does Trump want a solution? Does he want a peace? I don't think Trump knows what he wants. I think Trump is scared. This is where I personally stand. The man-child is scared. He doesn't understand the complexities of this problem. And so what he's going to do is sabotage the process so that there's failure so he can walk away. That's what I think Trump wants, because he's not a leader. He's not a man of courage. He's a coward who has gotten himself into a situation that's outside his capacity to understand, and he's going to withdraw from it. And I'm concerned that this could be a pattern, you know, because quitters, that's a pattern of behavior. And Donald Trump's a quitter when it comes to these decisive issues. I'm worried about the Iran negotiations, because there will come a time, if this thing is going to reach fruition, Donald Trump is going to have to give his stamp of approval on some very bold conclusions that give Iran capabilities that Trump is on record saying he will never allow. Israel definitely won't allow this or doesn't want it. And does Trump have the courage to actually say, yes, this is what I stand for, et cetera? Or as Professor Morandi said, will somebody sign a document then the next day when everybody starts attacking Trump, does the man child get his feelings hurt and come out and say something completely different? It's impossible. Impossible at this juncture to speak responsibly about Donald Trump and foreign policy, because we just don't know what this man's going to do.
Yeah. Professor Morandi, Donald Trump called the Iranian negotiators as intelligent. And what does he mean? And what is the outcome of the latest talks between Iran and the United States? We know that the foreign minister of Iran said that was difficult but useful. What does that mean to you?
It's very difficult to say, Nima. On the one hand, as we were discussing earlier, Witkoff, right before the latest round, he made some statements that were unacceptable to the Iranians. The Iranian foreign minister responded basically saying that if this continues, that we're going to go make similar public statements as well. And then right after the negotiations, we see Trump making this sort of statement and others making similar statements, which raise questions. If Witkoff was insisting at the negotiating table, well, they're indirect talks, of course, but if Witkoff was insisting that there's going to be no enrichment, then I think that that would have led to the talks ending, or at least the two sides would have just been sending messages back and forth that would not change anything. So possibly Witkoff at the in Oman was not saying the same thing that he was saying to Breitbart, and that he was being more flexible but difficult. I'm just guessing. This is, you know, the taxi driver outside, you know, driving by our house. His guess is as good as mine. But my my guess would be that Witkoff is what he's saying in Oman is not the exact thing that he said to Breitbart.
Can I just jump in with my taxi cab version of this? Imagine me being a Iranian cab driver right now. First of all, don't get in my cab because I don't know the city well enough and we'll just get lost. But if you want to ask me about the nuclear program, I would say this. The third round, one of the interesting ways that it was described was that they were beginning to have technical discussions. You don't have technical discussions about broad policy issues. Technical discussions come when you start talking about brass tacks in terms of monitoring regime of a nuclear enrichment program. And Witkoff was part of that. This happened before he made the statements. And when they left the third round, both sides were optimistic. They're like, okay, things are happening. Then Witkoff said what he said. I think that's because Trump came under a lot of pressure from Israel. And I think that Witkoff's statements were directly linked to the Israeli government's posture. Now that Trump's had his spat with Netanyahu, we're now moving into a fourth round of negotiations. And again, the technical aspect is very much part of this. So, and I think Witkoff has come out and said some things just this morning where he said that the key thing is that Iran will not have a nuclear weapons program. That's saying that Iran will have a nuclear energy program, a nuclear enrichment program. So I think that the Trump administration has made decisions that say, no, we are going to have a deal if a deal can be finalized that's premised on Iran retaining nuclear enrichment. Now, once you accept that, that's the big hurdle for the United States. Now it comes down to how do we build a nuclear enrichment program that gives Iran what it wants while providing political cover from us, meaning that so that we can go out and explain to people how this is not a nuclear weapons program. And that's where they're at right now. That's complicated. It's difficult, but that ain't nearly as difficult as overcoming that first hurdle. Because as Professor Morani said, if the going in position of the United States is no enrichment, then there is no need to further these discussions. So obviously, I believe the United States, Steve Witkoff, has made a decision that we are looking for a deal that includes enrichment. And I'm very, very, very pleased by this, because this is exactly what needs to happen to resolve this issue. But let's look at Russia. Witkoff came out of discussions with the Russians saying, I fully understand the Russian position. I understand what the Russians are talking about in terms of territory. I understand we know what the Russian position is. And believe me, Professor Morandi makes it out clear that the Iranian position is non-negotiable. The Russian position is equally non-negotiable. And so when Witkoff comes in and tells the president what the Russian position is and reflects the reality that it's non-negotiable, and then the president turns around and allows Steve Kellogg to articulate things that are the exact opposite of what the Russian position is, imply that that is American policy. When the president speaks about Europe as if the European disagreements with Russia are valid and carry weight, that means that whatever Witkoff said, whatever he negotiated, whatever he discussed with the Russians, doesn't matter in the mind of the man-child, which means that whatever Witkoff comes out of in these discussions with Iran, they could come out with the perfect deal. The fact is, I have enough faith and confidence in Steve Witkoff and his Iranian counterparts that they can craft a deal that is workable. Can the man child accept this? Can he withstand the criticism? That's always going to be the big question, not the quality of the deal. The deal is going to be a good deal if they can finish this. The question is, what is the man-child going to do when people start attacking him? Is he going to throw a temper tantrum, start crying, start complaining to mommy, and then say, no, 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 I reject that. I'm taking my ball and I'm going home.
Yeah, I agree with Scott that, by the way, that the Russians are not going to give any serious concessions to the West. But if Trump on day one had made the decision to accept President Putin's demands, President Putin could have made it easier for him on smaller issues to make it easier for him to convince the public, even though he had a mandate back then and he could have done it anyway. But he could have given it him something to make it easier. But now what's probably going to happen is that we're going to have a war where the Russians go further and perhaps go all the way to Odessa. And if there is going to be a deal, it's going to be more difficult for Trump to convince the public, the elites, because he's lost that momentum, and the Russians are going to make bigger demands. Because if they take more territory and they lose more men, and then they go back to the negotiating table, it's not going to be like what it was a couple of months ago. There are a number of things here that I find interesting, but I don't have any. They don't necessarily help me reach a conclusion. Possibly one of the reasons why we see that this round of negotiations has been more positive than expected, which again doesn't mean that we're going to have a deal, but at this stage it seems to, because a lot of people were saying, well, after what Witkoff said, then there's not going to be any progress, may have to do with the fact that Trump is deeply irritated or angry with Netanyahu, or even further than that as Scott is implying. But then again, if that changes, that could mean that U.S. policy with regards to the negotiations would change too. So it's unclear. Again, it goes back to what I was saying about China. Trump, basically, when he made this move, everyone was wondering. It was a very daring move, in my opinion, a very foolish move, but a very daring move. But he retreated, you know, very. No one was expecting this agreement to take place with the Chinese so swiftly. Everyone was saying, well, they're going to speak and then we'll have to see what happens. And then we saw, you know, they literally announced a deal. Well, not a provisional deal or a deal of sorts, because they, as I said, they went back to where they were before Liberation Day. And this is going to be a 3-month process, and who knows what's going to happen then. But the point is that this does show, as I said earlier, that Trump is flexible. China, for example, the Ansarullah, but it does show possibly that his flexibility towards Ansarullah, Hamas, and Iran is possible, and that it may be linked to Netanyahu. It probably is linked to his relationship with Netanyahu, but I can't say for certain. But all of this can be reversed, just like the talks with China can be reversed. Just like Russia, we already seen that they've been reversed. Russia, the war in Ukraine had a solution. And now we are miles away from that solution. And we may not have a solution anytime soon. This year may be a year of war. And again, who knows, maybe Trump will shift course on Ukraine tomorrow. It's so confusing, and it makes me more cautious than ever before to talk about anything, because I'd always get things wrong, and now I'm sure I'm going to get things wrong. but the war in Ukraine is, for me at this stage, a very bad sign of what can happen, because it was it could have had a good, decent ending, and now it's going to possibly have a very bloody ending. On the other hand, you have China, which was going to lead us to a global economic catastrophe, which we still are going to see the consequences in the coming weeks, according to economists. But he was able to shift policy and decrease the damage. Who knows what's going to happen with the nuclear program? Is it going to go down the Ukraine-Russia road, or is it going to go down the US China road, which all of these could change, by the way, tomorrow. But what I'm saying is that we're seeing a lot of unpredictability, and things that we were hoping or expecting to happen did not happen. It did not materialize in Ukraine. And things that we did not expect to turn in a positive way, at least with China, it did happen. So what does that mean for the nuclear deal? The good thing, the good news, is that the Iranian side knows the details of the nuclear program. And I'm sure, I don't know who Trump is using or who Witkoff is using for his negotiations. The nuclear program has been negotiated many times. Most recently, it was negotiated in depth between Dr. Bagheri, who was a deputy foreign minister and head of the file, and they almost had a deal with the P4 plus one, with Americans, you know, guiding the Europeans from behind in Vienna. We almost had a deal. Dr. Arochi was the deputy of Dr. Zarif. He knows exactly what's going on. So even though there's a lot of details and there are lots of complexities, it would, if the two sides want to have a deal, and I'm sure the Iranians want to within the framework of their principles, if there is the will to have a deal, it is achievable more swiftly than before, because everything is known. All the routes have been explored. All the debates have taken place in the past. So it doesn't have to be something that goes on for many months and just drag on. So that is the good news. But the problem is that for Trump, it can be hours, literally hours. On Truth Social, he says something and everything changes.
I'll just throw this in there. I think the good news for the Iranian program is that Iran has mature leadership that is sincerely looking out for the vested interests of the Iranian nation, the Iranian people, and that they recognize that war or a path towards war is not a solution, that finding a path towards peace is the solution. And so I think they'll be far more tolerant of the inconsistencies of the American Trump administration. And I say the same thing about China, very mature leadership. They don't want a devastating trade war with the United States. That doesn't meet China's goals and objectives at all. And I think the Chinese are going to show a lot more maturity and patience with the tempestuous nature of Trump. Russia has shown extreme patience with Trump. The problem, though, is that Trump isn't dealing with Russia alone. You have Zelensky, who is just a failure of a leader who doesn't care about his people and is negotiating as a tool of Europe. And Europe is in a very compromised position, where they are committed to the strategic defeat of Russia, and they're not willing to back down from that position, even though it's unattainable. They're committing.
I thought when you meant compromise, you were talking about the train issue.
I mean, if the European media is not going to go crazy about, you know, the possibility of their senior leadership stimulating themselves artificially, then, you know, maybe that's the norm in Europe. I don't know. But the fact is, Europe is not a partner in this process. Europe is a disruptor. And Trump has allowed Europe. Trump could have cut Europe out in a heartbeat. I mean, just sliced him right off and said, you're just not a factor in any of this. But Trump has brought them in and allowed them to inject themselves. Even today, as before we came on, I still have to figure out what it meant. But Kellogg is now saying, yeah, America may support the deployment of European troops into Ukraine. What part of dead European troops don't you understand? And this is why Kellogg should be permanently silenced or fired. Let him, if he wants to speak, let him go on Fox News as a private citizen and say what Steve Kellogg wishes would happen. But as long as he's a special envoy, I mean, this directly contradicts what Donald Trump has already said on this issue. It directly contradicts what the Secretary of Defense has said on this issue. And now Steve Kellogg's out there articulating policy at a very critical time. Do you want to sabotage any potential of a peace negotiation? Say that it's America's position that Europeans, once you get this magical, mythical 30-day ceasefire, that European peacekeepers will deploy west of the Dnieper River. Russia will say, no, they won't. Therefore, there won't be. It's sabotaging this. This is why I think this is deliberate by Trump. He is afraid of getting the peace that could happen because it requires him to concede to Russia things that once they're conceded will open him up for attack in Europe and here at the United States. And Trump isn't man enough to take that attack. A true leader would absorb that attack, go on national TV and explain to the American people why he did what he did. Trump is a man child, and a man child can just have a temper tantrum and run to his room and hide. That's Donald Trump. And that's why there won't be peace in Ukraine. And I agree with Professor Morande. There, if you want to ask me to commit to this, there nothing will come out of Istanbul on Thursday except this. The Russians will leave knowing there is no path towards peace. This is such a clarifying moment for the Russians and a necessary moment for the Russians. And again, I don't want to predict the future, but if I were the Russians, I would come back from that and say, since there is no path for peace, what we're seeing is the United States and Europe and Ukraine buying time to rebuild military capacity to put us in a weakened position, that we have never been stronger than we are right now. So right now is the moment to exploit our strength and change the strategic dynamic of this conflict by maybe transitioning from a special military operation to an active state of war that puts Kiev under the firing line, et cetera, but do something to break this paradigm that exists. Right now, Russia is winning a war of attrition, but a war of attrition is a very bloody thing for both sides. Russia's winning, but its sustainability over time, especially if the United States and Europe are trying to, boost Ukrainian killing capacity, why would Russia want to do that? So I think Russia is going to leave this with more clarity about what needs to be done. And I think this summer we're going to see the nature of the conflict in Ukraine change dramatically. It'll be horrible. It'll be bloody. It will be awful. But it's the only way Russia is going to bring an end to this conflict. This war will end on terms dictated to Ukraine by Russia, and the United States and NATO will be outside looking in. We're not going to be a part of how this conflict terminates.
So if we take Scott's logic and put it to what's going on in the region, I agree. I think the way things are going, Russia will have no option but to mobilize, and it's already mobilized. It's preparing itself for a summer offensive. They will probably take a very different route. They will hit hard and they will start pressing forward, and that could break the back, or probably will break the back of the Ukrainian army, but the casualties will be huge. It will be very, very bloody. And it will be like an earthquake for European politics and for the world, because, and this could have been stopped. It could have been prevented 2-3 months ago. But if we take this logic and come back to the region, that should make us very cautious about the future, because if the Europeans and Zelensky and the deep state, let's call it the deep state in Europe and the United States, don't want peace in Ukraine, then imagine how the neocons, Zionists, Netanyahu, and these forces will be working to undermine any degree of rapprochement between Iran and the United States, any decreasing intentions, because ultimately the problem in the region between Iran and the United States is not about the nuclear program, it's not about terrorism, it's not about human rights, it's not about children's rights, it's not about global warming, it's about Israel. And so the nuclear program is one of the key tools used by Iran's antagonists, Iran's opponents, to put pressure on the country because of Iran's support for the Palestinian cause. You don't see Turkey sanctioned. You don't see Doha or Qatar sanctioned. You don't see any of these countries sanctioned because none of them are really the governments are sincerely working to the detriment of the Israeli regime or maybe to the detriment of a politician, but not to the regime itself. Iran has been targeted and put under maximum pressure and maximum sanctions and threatened and antagonized and regime change operations have been carried out and terrorist attacks have been carried out because of Israel. So when you have this degree of antagonism, then the negotiations that take place in Oman or with Oman present, and if it's at an Omani embassy somewhere in Europe, they're very vulnerable. And the same is true with the ceasefire between the United States and Ansarullah and the Yemeni armed forces too. And the same is true with regards to Hamas. I think Scott alluded to this earlier, that yes, it is a big shift that the United States is directly negotiating with Hamas. This time around, they didn't back off or they didn't back down when the Israelis found out and started putting pressure on them. But that doesn't mean that the United States next week is going to continue down the road of this, what appears to be some sort of policy change. It could just simply be a blip on the radar. We don't know. I personally believe, though, this is the only prediction that I can make. I think that the United States is going to continue to decline. I think the way in which the trade war is being engineered is to the detriment of the United States. I think, although Trump made a smart move to retreat, but I think that the momentum, he's put things into motion across the world that will not be good for the United States. The fact that China was able to force Trump to go to the day before Liberation Day is going to embolden all those countries who are going to sit down with Americans and negotiate over tariffs, because all of them will see that China literally got what it wanted, so now we can do the same. They're going to have more cards to play with than China did, I think, because of what China did. On the other hand, the war in Ukraine is going to have very negative consequences for the United States and for Europe. It's going to be very bad and very bloody if they don't quickly shift gear. So this year is going to be a very important year, 2025. And I think that Iran, while it is going to hope for the best and work for the best, but it's going to be preparing itself for the worst. Iran is going to, as my understanding is, that Iran is preparing itself for some sort of military confrontation with the United States. That doesn't mean it's going to happen. I'm not saying that, but it is preparing itself. I don't believe there's going to be war between Iran and the United States. The United States does not have that ability. It's the world has changed. The United States would have to bring in 1.5 million people, 1990, that sort of thing, but much bigger. But the world has changed. The U.S. economy has changed. Iran has changed. Everything has changed. Iran's relations. Soon, we now hear that the Russian president, President Putin, is coming to Iran. The Iranian president is going to go on a state visit to China shortly. And then he's going to go there again for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Things have changed. And so in the region, the Israelis, they're much diminished. I'm not saying they're going to fall apart tomorrow, but they're much diminished. Things are not looking good for the United States economically, militarily, public diplomacy-wise. When it comes to Gaza, the world blames the West. This year is going to be a very key year, I think, in contemporary history, because so many things are in play. But the Iranians are preparing themselves. The Iranians are not going to be the ones to lead the negotiating table. They will, even though it's indirect talks, but the negotiating table is something that the Iranians are sitting at for two reasons. One is in the hope that there will be a deal, a decent deal where Iran's rights are respected and Iran will continue with its peaceful nuclear program and there will be a decrease in tension. But the second path is confrontation, or at least a continuation of what we have today where Trump constantly threatens Iran. But I think there is also a possibility of the United States carrying out strikes against Iran, which I think would not end well for the United States. I don't think it will end well for Israel. But Trump could be pushed into doing this. Who knows? He, after all, he murdered General Soleimani. And I think it's, I've never really heard the story, but ever since he said that Netanyahu pulled out at the last moment and that sort of thing, the first time I heard that, I think it for me, it was clear that the Israeli regime pushed him into. And this is something that could happen again in future. So again, all I've been saying during this hour or so of discussion is I don't know what's going to happen. But I think Iran is going to continue to negotiate until we get a deal or until the United States chooses to discontinue with the negotiation.
Yeah, Nima, you need to name this program, I don't know, because I think that's the mutual conclusion is when it comes to Trump, I don't know. Who does? Not even Trump.
I don't think Trump knows. I agree 100%. I do not think that the people around Trump can predict what he's going to do, and I don't think Trump knows what he's going to do.
No.
I'm not saying he's completely mad. I'm not saying it's complete chaos, but I do think that's who he is. I don't think he knows what he's going to do. I think this is not strategic uncertainty as they like to see it. I do think it is chaos. Now, whether it's what some have said and Scott alluded to, that whether it's the last person who speaks to him has the greatest influence, I don't know how it works. I'm sure it's many things together. But whatever it is, and whatever these factors are that make Trump who he is and what he is, it just makes it very difficult to predict the future. But one thing, as I said earlier, and I'm repeating myself, but I think it's important, one thing that it will do for certain is that it will make countries think about their relationships with one another without the United States. Yep. This is going to strengthen the bond between Iran and Russia, Russia and China. It is even going to raise questions in capitals of countries like India about the United States. Because if you don't know what the person who you're dealing with is going to do tomorrow, that makes it better for you to think about at least having other options too. And I would like to add, even though this is not being discussed, this brief conflict between India and Pakistan, which I hope never happens again, because war is not to the benefit of either side. Both sides have, their media has been saying a lot of nonsense and exaggerating. The only thing that came out of this, I don't think the Indians did much damage to Pakistan. I don't think the Pakistanis did much damage to the Indians. In fact, I think both of them were exaggerating, and they were being careful, even though people were killed. But what did come out of this is that Chinese military products have shown themselves to be better than people thought, and that they did better than the French and European weapons that were being used by India. And I think that, too, is something that people are going to calculate in the months. And just like DeepSeek, we were being told that, yeah, the Chinese can make good cell phones and they can do this, but the creativity is in the United States. And then suddenly I use DeepSeek. I don't use anything else. I mean, they're better than the other ones for the time being. So DeepSeek changed the perception of many, and of course it caused a huge fall in the stock market in the United States. But I think that while the fact that these French jets, advanced jets, were down by not so new Chinese jets and missiles, I think that is significant as well. And all of these combined, what's happening in Ukraine, the genocide in Gaza, the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the trade war, not just with China, but with the world, and the fact that China has emerged as capable. We lost Nima. The fact that China has emerged technologically capable, not just in AI, but in with regards to its military defense capabilities. I think this is all going to have to be factored in, and will be factored in by politicians across the world.
Yep,
Scott, going to have to go.
I gotta pretend that I'm Nima. There, Nima's back. Okay,
Nima, we hijacked your show. we're going to call it the Scott Muhammad Show. But we're done.
We concluded. We solved. Actually, we came up with global solutions, and we articulated it quite well.
Yeah, you missed it all.
Yeah,
you missed it all.
By the way, I think, Scott, what Professor Morandi just said is so much important for the foreign policy of the United States. He mentioned Vladimir Putin going to be in Iran, talking with Iranian leadership, and Iranian president going to China. I would wonder, what would that mean for the United States in the Middle East? Do they really want to be on the part of Israel? Do they really want to reconsider their policy in the long term? This is huge. And what's happening right now, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and what's going on, it's so much important, in my opinion, in the eyes of Donald Trump and his administration. How is that going to be perceived by the United States, in your opinion?
Well, when you say the United States, who are you talking about? The American people, the American Congress, the establishment, the Trump administration, the president? How are we defining the United States? Because there's different levels of perception and perspectives. I don't think the American people understand what's happening to them. I don't think the United States understands where we are. I will always advocate very strongly for the United States, and I've tried to be reality based in my approach. Even under Joe Biden, who I criticized vociferously, I believe that the United States was a relevant nation, in many ways, the relevant nation in the world on many issues. So even when nations disagreed with us, they had no choice but to deal with us, that they had to take in the American perspective, and their leaders had to fly to the United States or agree to meet with the United States. But the man-child has made America irrelevant. I mean, we really have just taken ourselves out of the running when it comes to, the major issues of the day. Saudi Arabia is hosting the American president, I believe, not because the president is there to save Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia is saying, we have to do something to prop this guy up because he's collapsing, and we don't want to live in a world where we have a geopolitical vacuum created by the rapid withdrawal of the United States as a relevant player on the global stage, which is what Trump is doing. Trump is forcing the issues, and these retreats that he's doing makes America irrelevant. We could have been the most relevant player in the Ukrainian-Russia deal. We could have made ourselves absolutely essential to that. What's going to happen instead is that we are going to withdraw, and Russia is going to be the only voice heard on this issue, which creates a vacuum in Europe. The deficit of American leadership requires Europe to come up with its own solution without America. We could be that if we were more assertive with Israel, we could be the defining voice. But by backing out, letting Netanyahu do things, he fills that vacuum. We become irrelevant. I'm afraid that's what we're doing. So the Saudis, being the very pragmatic people they are, I mean, what was the first deal they came up with? Giving Trump a victory. We're sending $600 billion. We're going to invest $600 billion in America. Now Trump gets to go, I'm the greatest thing since sliced bread. I got $600 billion in from the Saudis. I'm awesome. I'm the man child. America loves me. And then what else that comes out of this? Nothing. Nothing. He's not going to get what he wants on global oil prices. He's not going to get the Saudis to divorce their relationship with Iran. He's not going to get the Saudis to back off their relationship with China. He's not going to get the Saudis to back off of anything. The Saudis are there to make the president look good and give him, you know, something to help prop him up, because they don't want a geopolitical vacuum. America under Donald Trump is becoming irrelevant. And that's not a good thing for the world. And again, I think, to be frank, I think the Iranians recognize this, which is why the Iranians are bending over backwards to, you know, stay at the negotiating table. Because as bad as an inconsistent Trump is, America has been the dominant player in the world for decades, the dominant player. The world's not ready to operate without an America out there playing a prominent role, not a dominant role, but a prominent role. Trump is in the process of even eliminating that possibility. He's making America irrelevant. And this is a dangerous situation for a number of reasons. One, the world's not ready to operate in that environment. Two, there still is a need for American leadership. And three, having a man-child throw a temper tantrum when he has his button on the nuclear, you know, the finger capable of pushing the nuclear button is not a solution any wants. The instability that's engendered by the inconsistency of the Trump administration is one of the greatest threats to international peace and security today.
Professor Marandi, do you believe that Russia and China are in the process of being more active, being more, making more substantial decisions about the Middle East? How do they see Middle East, in your opinion, right now? Has their mind changed during the past, let's say, 4 years or 3 years?
I think it's more than just Russia and China. I think it's what's happened over the last 19 months is has changed the way the world perceives the United States, the West, and the Israeli regime. Even inside the United States, you have some key supporters of Trump hitting out at AIPAC, at Israel. You have a key congresswoman. You have whether it's Candace Owens or who's very hard hitting on the Israeli shit. And you have hosts of people nowadays. Just I think hours ago, Tucker Carlson. I didn't watch it, but he did another show which was highly, I would assume, is highly critical of Israeli regime and Israeli supporters, and this is huge. You see small signs, you know, accumulating across Europe of change in mentality. You see the Financial Times. You see the New York Times printing things that they wouldn't do. So I'm not saying that things are, you know, there's going to be a sea change, but things are changing. And that is, you know, Russia's role and China's role in the region and across the world is going to change as well. So as the United States continues to sacrifice itself for the sake of the elites, whether it's the deep state or the elites in Europe or Zelensky or whatever, as it continues to sacrifice itself for the Israeli regime, as it continues to make foolish moves in with regards to the trade war, which I understand some of the reasons why they want to put tariffs in place. It's because the United States no longer produces anything, but you know, something that has been done over the last 40 years is not going to be reversed in 4 months or 4 years. And also there's this sort of paradox with the dollar. On the one hand, Trump wants it to remain the reserve currency, but I think one reason why the United States can't be competitive at home is because of the dollar being the global reserve currency. So the United States is in this terrible position. And as it declines and, or Scott says, becomes irrelevant, or at least relatively speaking, less relevant, I think that it's inevitable that China and Russia and Iran and other major players are going to fill in that space. But that, you know, as empires, as we've read in history books and as we've heard from people who read history well, as empires decline, they become more aggressive, they become more irrational, they become more hostile, and the speed in which this empire is declining is unprecedented in world history. Usually in the past it would take centuries. In the case of the UK, depending on how you define it, it took a century at least. But in the case of the United States, it's largely because of its own goals, or at least partially, it's going down very fast. And who knows what that could lead to. It could lead to a very dangerous situation.
Scott, do you want to add something before wrapping up?
No, I think Professor Morandi and I are of one mind here. So,
yeah. Thank you so much, Scott and Professor Morandi, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thanks. I hate beating. I just have to say this. I have to say this on record. I hate beating up on my country. I really do. I love my country. I mean, it brings tears to my eyes to imagine how much I love my country. And I want my country to succeed, not at the expense of others, but I want my country to succeed. I want the American people to thrive, to prosper. And I want us to live up to our potential as a nation. We are a good people. We are a productive people. We are an intelligent people. We are a moral people. And we are floundering. We are failing. You know, but when you invite me on and you ask me questions, I'm going to give you an honest answer. But I have to say that this program, no matter how much smile I put on my face, this program hurt me deeply. It pains me to have a program like this, because to be honest requires to say things that are critical of my country, that every time I say them, it hurts, because it's the truth. It's the reality. And it's not the America I want it to be. It's not the America it should be. But I just wanted to say that, because I think I try to cover my pain with some frivolity, with some humor, and with good spirit. But this program hurt me deeply. It really did. It pains me. This is a very painful time for me to watch, as Professor Morandi said, the rapid decline of a country I love.
Well, let's hope for better days for everyone across the globe, and an end to the genocide and to ethnic cleansing, and a more just global system, and better days for all people, Americans, Iranians, Russians, Europeans, Africans, Asians, Latin people from across Latin America. Hopefully hopefully our children will see better days.
We just got to get rid of the man child, but we have three more years.
Well, I think we have to get rid of a lot of man children.
We'll start with the man child. All right, guys. Thanks a lot. It was a pleasure.
Take care. Bye.